What did you want to talk about?
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this April 12th. We have a lot of stuff to do. We're going to have some hearings. I'm going to ask people to be as brief as they possibly can to continue to do that. And I'm going to announce, to begin with, that we're rescheduling four bills Monday because we don't have the paperwork for them and other reasons. We'll reschedule House Bill 2391, House Bill 2835, House Bill 2837, and House Bill 3440. They're all scheduled for work sessions to move to Rules Committee, but we'll do that all on Monday. I'm going to open up a public hearing. As I can get my paperwork here, we have a ream of paper in front of me today. Where are we starting? I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3415. Madam Administrator, what do we have? What happens if I didn't gavel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3415 comes to you at the request of Representative Noble and others. This establishes the Mental Health for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Individuals Bill of Rights. And that's as far as I'm going to go because the panel can do a much better job.
Go for it.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the community. I did it again, committee, but we are a community. My name is Ron Noble. I'm the state representative from House District 24, which is McMinnville all the way through Hillsborough. During the 2015 regular session of the legislature, the Ways and Means Committee concluded from what was then Senate Bill 449 that a community needs assessment was needed to identify the social, health, and educational disparities experienced by the deaf and hard of hearing communities and granted $200,000 in general funds to support this effort. Western Oregon University's Regional Resource Center on Deafness was awarded a contract and completed this assessment this past fall. As stated in the report, the purpose of the project was to identify for DHS and the legislature the barriers that make it difficult for members of the deaf, deaf-blind, and hard-of-hearing communities to successfully engage in social, educational, and health services to make recommendations for closing any gaps. The ability to communicate, to understand, and be understood is the cornerstone of all areas of human development. It may look different from person to person, but without it, really everything else is lost. The needs of individuals who are deaf, hard of hearing, deaf-blind, or additional disabilities are met in a variety of different ways, and the general public and service providers alike often do not recognize this, resulting in a one-size-fits-all mindset. This sometimes creates frustration and blame between consumers and service providers, and when gatekeepers do not respect the individual's communication needs, discrimination can often follow. Access to mental health services practitioners who understand the cultural and communication issues involved for all aspects of deaf and hard of hearing communities and who can communicate directly with those consumers is at a crisis level in our state. Whether it's for crisis counseling, everyday issues, or a psychiatric disability, Oregon does not have the capacity to serve its deaf and hard of hearing citizens who need these services. So in response to this study, House Bill 3415 establishes a Mental Health for Deaf, Deaf-Blind, and Hard of Hearing Individuals Bill of Rights to ensure that mental health programs throughout this state provide culturally and linguistically affirmative mental health services to this population in their primary communication mode, style, or language. The Dash 1 amendment, I believe, that is before you simply provides clarification to the initial bill by including the term deaf-blind. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony and turn it over to the senator.
Great. Good afternoon for the Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Corvallis, Albany, and the surrounding areas. I'm very pleased to be here today with Representative Noble. We, on the opening days of session, I was surprised to realize it was this Ron Noble. We have been neighbors in the past, and it's just really a great privilege to sit here with him, particularly for this bill. The need means is we all know for access to mental health services across the state are significant. We have a tremendous amount of work to do. And in fact, about a year and a half ago, we did a tour around the state. We went to about 8 different communities to solicit from consumers of mental health services what their needs were as it related to mental health. And one of the, it was a great tour. A lot of really good things happened. But one of the things that was disappointing was that we had individuals that came that were deaf and hard of hearing, that wanted to participate in the hearing, that had called ahead to ask for accommodations, and the sign interpreters did not show up. So around this incredibly important issue of access to mental health services, the deaf and hard of hearing community could not be heard. And if you do not have access to language, accommodations, and interpretation to even talk about what your needs are, how can your needs even be met? And that is why I felt a particularly deep obligation and thrill to support this legislation for this population of people. I particularly appreciate the way that the language talks both about this as an accommodation, as a language, and as a culture. And that is something really important to think about when talking about the deafblind and hard of hearing communities. I know that the advocates will do a wonderful job speaking to the bill, and I certainly have been impressed with the tremendous work done in the building this session. And I also really do want to thank everyone for working so hard on these issues. I'm glad to see the accommodations in this room. I know that takes a lot of work. It's taken a lot of patience on the part of individuals asking for accommodations that are not always available, and we need to continue to endeavor to make sure that accommodations are available every day, all the time, when they are needed, so that whether it is access to mental health services or access to the legislative process, all Oregonians are treated equally and have the same access to services. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm happy to be here in support of House Bill 3415. I have a personal issue, a personal reason why I so see the need for these Bill of Rights. I have a sister. She's 2 years older than I am, and she was born deaf because my mother had the German measles, the 3-day measles, and that part of her ears did not develop, and so she's been deaf. Oregon is one of the worst states for making accommodations for the deaf. My sister now lives in New York. She did live in Washington, D.C., and the services that are provided in other states is so much better than what we do in Oregon. And so I'm so happy that the deaf, blind, and hard of hearing are coming forward with so many bills this session, because we have neglected them. We have really neglected them. And so this is a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Chair, and we need to go provide a forum to Senator Taylor, because we are 2 people out of her 5-person committee.
Is a dash one member, is that right?
There is.
We can talk about that. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. I am actually the co-chief sponsor on this bill, so I probably should have came down there, but you guys did a wonderful job. Part of one of the reasons why I, too, joined in on the bill, and thank you, Representative Noble, for bringing it forward. In addition to being hearing impaired, autistic nephew who does not speak but can do some sign. And so I think it's also important to think about and take into consideration that population. So for me, that was heartfelt, especially on the mental health side. But I also think that it's going to be important down the line for us to also provide opportunities for folks to learn how to sign so that we have more interpreters. My daughter chose to take sign as her third language and ended up at a high school, thankfully, that offered that. But not all colleges accept that as a third language. So I think we've got some work to do. But thanks, Representative Noble, for allowing me to join in on this with you, and look forward to moving this forward.
You want to talk a bit about the dash one?
Can we leave to do that?
I can do that.
Bye, ladies.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair. The dash one amendments really just add the term deafblind to the bill. Didn't change anything else. It's just to be as inclusive as possible with this population and ensure we're not leaving anybody out.
Thank you. I ask that because we won't have the paperwork to move it today, but we'll carry it over till Friday.
Thank you.
Would you call the next panel, please?
Stephen Brown, Denise Hackett, Bradley Houck, and then the last one is Dr. Brian Hartman.
When you're ready, please introduce yourself.
Okay, I guess I will start. Hello, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today. My name is Stephen Brown. I am the Vice President of the Oregon Association of the Deaf, and I am a mental health therapist in Washington, and I am licensed. I just want to provide a brief testimony to encourage all of you to support this Bill of Rights for mental health in our community, because we really need to increase access and visibility for those mental health services. For instance, I've been working with a therapist in Washington because there have been no one to provide supervision for me for licensure in Oregon. It was really difficult for me to find that supervision, so I have to go to Tacoma so that I could work with a deaf psychologist there. So I've been doing that for the last 4 years, earning the hours required for licensure, and my goal is to continue my practice there for another 2 years and then transfer to Oregon. I'm hoping that this bill will help by establishing a coordinator to work with the Board of Social Workers, psychologists, and licensed counselors and marriage therapists to ensure that their regulations provide easier access to services so that people can get licensure and supervision more easily. There, for instance, for telehealth services, they are very limited here in Oregon, and hopefully those will increase accesses to rural areas, and I'm hoping that that's something that can be worked on. So thank you for listening to my testimony. I'll turn it over now. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Brad Houck. I am an LCSW, which is a licensed clinical social worker. I've been an LCSW since 2009, and I have a private practice here in Salem. And I have 18 years altogether of experience in social work. I started my social work practice in the state of North Carolina. They already had established service provision for deaf and hard of hearing individuals in several regions of the state. So they provided services for children with mental health issues, adults, and those who were struggling with substance abuse. Before that, there was nothing for the deaf and hard of hearing community. Once that program was established, I was hired to join in that effort to help the deaf community there. When I moved to Oregon, I really noticed the scant services that are provided here, especially in comparison to North Carolina, and the huge need for those mental health services. I'm really proud of the group of people who are here today who have worked to build this bill and to start these efforts. I've seen in Salem that we do have more services available than there are in Portland, even though they have a much larger deaf community there. They have almost no services available to them. Eugene, our second largest city, has almost no services available there. And the mental health programs around the state, many of them have no idea how to work with deaf and hard of hearing individuals. And the deaf and hard of hearing community doesn't always know their rights, and the service providers are not able to meet their needs. I believe that every deaf and hard of hearing person needs counseling. Imagine encountering hearing people every day who don't speak your language, feeling frustrated all the time, feeling depressed, not knowing how to get what you need, maybe having family members who can't communicate with you, family members neglecting their deaf children who grow up with a lot of anger issues. I see that very frequently because of the oppression that they experience throughout their lives. So there really is a serious need. And people say that this is a hearing world, but I say that it's not, because deaf people live in it too. But that is the reality that we face with hearing people every day. But I'm hoping this bill will be a good start to providing more access to services that we desperately need. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Dr. Denise Hugh Hackett, and I'm I'm the primary investigator for the community needs assessment. Maybe you're familiar with that report that I wrote. I'm the assistant professor at Western Oregon University, and I teach the rehab and mental health counseling program there. I have the deaf track, and it's growing more and more in the mental health counseling and working with the deaf and hard of hearing population. And I've struggled with the simple issues, as we've heard spoken about today. When I travel around Oregon to collect data for the community needs assessment, I only had 8 months to gather all that data while I was working full-time as a professor. That wasn't a lot of time. So we collected mental health information, data. And I have it in my written testimony, some of the information there, and you can read that. But the point is that there's a lot of research and a lot of evidence published showing the disparity of deaf and hearing, and the suicide rates is significantly higher. There's a lot of connection with the isolation and depression. This should not have to happen. I'm not sure if you're aware, but 95% of deaf and hard of hearing people are from hearing families. Most of them don't know sign. They can't communicate properly. They miss so much. And just the informal learning, like conflict resolution skills, is critical to interacting with hearing people around them. Because,
there's a lot of oppression.
A lot of oppression of not establishing those foundational skills. So before I moved here to Oregon in 2015, that wasn't too long ago, 2015, I worked at a clinic in New York, and they provided services to the deaf and hard of hearing. And when I moved here, I was shocked. I wasn't prepared to see the lack of services that were here. And it was one of the worst states for deaf and hard of hearing people. It was embarrassing because this is a beautiful state. Beautiful mountains. This is a dream state for many people. But they didn't provide access. So please support this bill. This is the first step of many. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Representative Greenlick and committee members, my name is Dr. Brian Hartman. I am deaf and a clinical forensic psychologist. I have been practicing in Oregon since 2006 and have been licensed here since 2008. I am here today representing the Oregon Psychological Association, the largest organization in Oregon advocating for psychologists. We are familiar with the substantial research literature that demonstrates that deaf and hard of hearing individuals, as a group, are at greater risk of developing diagnosable mental health disorders. OPA strongly supports inclusive and culturally appropriate services to all Oregon mental health consumers. Having reviewed House Bill 3415, as well as the National Association of the Deaf's Model Mental Health for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Individuals Bill of Rights Act, we support the overall goals of the bill. That said, we have substantial reservations regarding the bill as written and are concerned that there will be unintended consequences, including creating additional barriers to service access. Portions of this bill will require modification of a substantial number of licensure statutes and administrative rules due to proposed exemptions from licensure, leaving consumers with no recourse in the case of unprofessional, unethical, or illegal behavior on the part of a provider. Additionally, there are numerous areas in the bill, as currently written, that are not feasible, such as the section that states the Oregon Health Authority is responsible for monitoring courts. These and other concerns are discussed in greater detail in the written documentation provided to the committee. Given that Oregon's mental health system is large, complex, and unique, OPA would propose a legislative work group be convened to develop proposals for the provision of mental health services to deaf, deafblind, and hard-of-hearing Oregonians and their families. The goals of the work group would be to ensure that a comprehensive system of care is developed to ensure that accessible and culturally and linguistically appropriate services are provided to this diverse population in a way that protects the public, is sustainable, and provides services equivalent to those provided to Oregonians without hearing loss. We would recommend that this group would be most effective with the inclusion of individuals that possess expertise in the civil and forensic organ mental health systems, deafness, provision of mental health services to deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing Oregonians, and interpreting in mental health, legal, and forensic mental health settings. Our written testimony provides specifics of this proposal. Should the committee choose to advance the bill as introduced, our written testimony contains specific proposed amendments that address some of the most salient issues. Thank you for your consideration and your commitment to ensuring high-quality mental health services for all Oregonians.
Dr. Harmon, is OPA opposing the bill?
OPA is not formally opposing the bill. We are suggesting either an amendment
to develop something that is better than what was originally introduced.
Or, given the time frame, we would pass the bill on to the Senate. You can talk to them about amendments in there, because we're about out of time. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3415 and roll the work session on House Bill 2415 to Friday. I'm sorry, 3415. And I'm going to close the public hearing. Did you already do? the gavel and everything. Should we go with the next one? Or?
Well, Representative Johnson
won't be here.
Isn't here yet. I don't see him.
All right.
So if you want to.
Let's go with the next one.
He will help. 2834.
Ready? All right. You want me to go down there?
Yeah. Please. Yeah. Okay. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2834. What do we have on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill states that it requires the Oregon Health Authority to conduct a study to evaluate the state's Medicaid delivery system. However, we have a Dash 1 amendment that replaces the measure that requires the Oregon Board of Dentistry, Oregon Medical Board, and the Oregon State Board of Nursing to adopt uniform rules to restrict in-use sedation services to certain licensed healthcare professionals. This amendment was requested at the request of Representative Hayden, who will now kick off the discussion on that, Mr. Chair.
Is there another amendment as well?
There is the Dash 4, and he may choose to mention it.
All right.
So we have Representative Hayden. Do you want your Representative Hayden? Do you want to bring your anesthesiologist?
Yeah,
up
sure. They could come up.
Is it?
Dan. Hagen Gruber. Ready?
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative for House District 7. This is an amendment to a bill that is related to health care. For people that have seen this bill before, it was brought to this committee for discussion in 2015 with the intent of getting collaboration between the Oregon Dental Board, the Oregon Medical Board, and the Oregon Board of Nursing. There was some success with that process, although it was limited, and the Oregon Board of Nursing, the Dental Board, and the Medical Boards all have worked on updating and continue to update their protocols for in-office sedation that our Oregonians utilize for the purposes of having many medical procedures done. In Oregon, we have something called a coordinated health care system that the triple aim of that is to lower cost. When we have procedures done in the hospital, the cost is higher than if we can have them done in the office. And if we have them done in surgery centers, one of the bills that we're discussing, we can curb costs there. So we're always trying to bend the cost curve. When it comes to in-office sedation, most providers that provide this services work within the realm of a class one or a healthy categorization of physical health for a person, or a class two, which is just a little bit less healthy. Once you get into a class three, it's considered they have some severe systemic concern. So those cases are not typically done in an in-office sedation setting. They are usually referred to either an oral surgeon's office or a surgery center or a hospital. And so the intent of this bill is to deal with the increasing amount, particularly in dental offices, of sedations being provided by an anesthesiologist or a dentist or an oral surgeon or a nurse anesthetist. It treats all of those categories the same. It doesn't call anybody out differently on that to make sure that these high acuity cases are getting to the right location. So it would make no change to what we're doing currently for the two healthy categories. Most board rules make these recommendations, but in anything, there is always the possibility of an outlier, what we call the bad actors, that might be, under current rules amongst those three boards, be able to provide a sedation to a patient that is a higher acuity, and that is a concern. This bill would not put anything in statute. It's simply asking those three boards to get together between now and January 1st, 2018 to come up in a collaborative effort. And I know that's a big lift when you're asking three medical boards to work together in a collaborative effort to put some sort of sideboards around when do we treat these higher acuity cases and where is it appropriate for them to be treated. There is a carve-out. This has caused a lot of confusion. It did 2 years ago. It's causing confusion now. Some people feel like they are being singled out. The carve-out says if you have, and this is typically for oral surgeons, if you have an office that's set up and you have direct connection with a hospital, you would continue to allow to be doing these higher acuity cases or a ASA class 3 cases. Now, that's controversial because some people feel like that treating those high acuity cases is taking something away from them, even though it is not standard for treat those except for the carve-out that we have provided for. So in a regular dental office, you would not treat those cases. You might in an oral surgeon's office. And so it's very simple. We put on OLIS today what these categories are. Number one, number two, no change. That's where all this work happens. If we have somebody that's an outlier that's trying to treat these higher acuity cases and they have a connection to a hospital or they have a transfer agreement or they have admitting privileges, we're continuing to allow that. If this person is a high acuity case where a nurse anesthetist, a dentist, a physician, all being treated the same here, would not normally treat that case, we don't want an outlier to be able to come to Oregon and treat that case perhaps out of a dental van or something in a mobile scenario, which I do, but I don't do sedation in them. We don't want that to happen. So I've asked one of my colleagues here, when did you start at Riverbend?
95.
So we have worked together in Riverbend Hospital doing dental sedation cases since 1995. I joined there in 94 for the last 23 years together for special needs people. Over the last 3 years, because of this push, the anesthesia department has some information that I'd like them to share on the protocols that they go through to provide this in-office sedation for the Class 1 and Class 2. So
please be brief with.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The time you need, but no more.
I'll keep it short. Promise. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having me, and thank you, Representative Hayden, for inviting us today, or for inviting me to speak to the committee. My name is Dan Hagengruber. I'm an anesthesiologist with Northwest Anesthesia Physicians. We provide care. There's 49 of us in my group, provide care at Riverbend Hospital in Eugene. I've been taking care of neonates, pediatric and adult patients since 1995. About 3 years ago, my group was asked to be part of a collaborative effort to develop oversight protocols for Lane County, specifically the pediatric committee, the pediatric call team in my group who takes care of neonates and healthy children in the hospital, to develop some guidelines to provide care in Lane County to ensure that safety was the primary goal when delivering care to children in the office setting. In the last 10 years in this country, there's been a real push to move to an office-based setting for cost-saving efforts and also for convenience for other factors. There's a less stressful environment for children. There's a lot of advantages to doing it in this environment, but we can't do it at the loss of safety for kids. Several of us in the pediatric team at my group traveled around the country and talked to different groups to see what was being done in other cities. And we wrote a set of guidelines that was then taken back to our pediatric surgery team, three pediatric surgeons, as well as the two main pediatric groups in town. And they signed off on the consensus statement saying that if you want to provide care in Lane County, you need to meet these guidelines to ensure that safety is being followed. Our goal was to basically be able to look at patients, families, and look at patients and say that if you have care in an office-based setting, you are getting the exact same quality of care as you would in a tertiary care facility, be that a hospital or a surgery center. And so we set the bar to the same level as if you were having surgery at a tertiary care facility. Since that time, we've been asked to actually begin to provide that care in Lane County, and we've set up a mobile dental anesthesia setting where we travel to dentist's office and provide general anesthesia in the office for healthy children and dentists. And it's proved to be kind of a win-win situation. The children do better. We found it enjoyable. The dentists enjoy having the care provided in their office. And so we've done it without adverse events, and that's our goal to continue that. I'm excited about the beginnings of this discussion to begin to have state oversight on safety for children. That remains our primary goal, to make sure that nothing is ever enacted that's named after a child who has died in an office setting. And that's really what our guidelines were set up to establish, to ensure excellent preoperative evaluation, intraoperative care, and a postoperative process, and continue that rolling forward. So I thank you for the time and attention to this.
Thank you. Are there any questions this panel? You call the next panel, please.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I apologize if I get it wrong. Is it Marvin?
Marlon Michelle?
Yes.
Can I defer till the end?
Pardon me?
Can I defer till the end?
Well,
I guess you have other people who want to.
There's only like four people left, so.
Okay, well, I'll defer afterwards.
Okay.
Thank
you. Norman Azias? Sarah Wickenhagen? Michael Ray?
Again, identify yourself and please be as brief as you can.
Full Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Norman Ozins. I'm a board-certified oral surgeon. Today I'm representing the Oregon Dental Association and the Oregon Society of Oral Maxillofacial Surgeons. I currently have a private practice in the Portland area. My training was at Indiana University. I have a variety of experience with anesthesia, not just with in-office anesthesia, but also in third world countries where I at least two or three times a year go for cleft lip and palate missions. And I too volunteer on dental vans where anesthesia is limited. Just first and foremost, with the current bill as stated, 2834-1, the Oregon Dental Association is in opposition for that for a variety of reasons, and including the Oregon Society of Oral Maxillofacial Surgeons. I think the well-intentioned bill, is intended to protect the public, and I think everybody's here with the same intention. When we start to somewhat restrict the ASA classification to certain individuals who have hospital admitting privileges, I think there are some flaws in that thought process. I think number one, having admitting privileges to a hospital speaks nothing to one's competence in the ability to provide safe and effective anesthesia. Also, there are many providers who may be oral surgeons in the state who limit their practice mostly to office procedures, and they may not have admitting privileges. They may have other forms of privileges, or they may only work at an outpatient surgery center. There was some mention from the anesthesiologist before about pediatric anesthesia and us wanting to make it a safer environment and prevent deaths. And my point to that would be that oftentimes our pediatric population is, in fact, ASA 1 and 2. So this delineation between the healthy and the less healthy, I don't think makes sense when it comes to safety and pediatric anesthesia. As we all know, we had a death of a soul, or we lost a soul in our community up in Vancouver not long ago. Again, there's still an investigation going on with that, so we don't know the facts per se, but my understanding, and this is hearsay, is that, the provider was an anesthesiologist, and I do not believe the patient was ASA 3, another point that I'd like to make, and it comes from a personal experience, is that a death in the office or a death under an anesthetic can happen not only in a dental office or in an oral surgery office or an outpatient surgery center. I've witnessed one anesthetic death in my career. I was a resident. I was at a level one trauma center in Indianapolis, Indiana. During that death, during extubation or waking up of the patient, two board-certified anesthesiologists were present. A trauma surgeon came in. Three oral maxillofacial surgeons were present. Due to human error, the patient still died. And that experience stuck with me for some time. So I think it's important to realize that, yes, we want to be safe, but if there is a death in any situation, whether it's a dental office or an outpatient surgery center, yes, they need to be investigated closely, but it does not necessarily mean incompetence, because it can happen in a variety of places. And the third point I'd like to make is with ASA 3 patients, at least the language as stated currently says sedation. Well, at least in the Dental Practice Act, we have multiple levels of sedation, minimal sedation, moderate sedation, deep sedation, general anesthesia. And yes, of course, very few people would consider full general invasive anesthesia on an ASA 3 patient. However, if a person can't provide minimal sedation or perhaps less invasive sedative techniques to someone who's ASA 3, well, then their arms are somewhat tied behind their back. So it does have some limitations to access to quality care. I teach the medical emergencies for the dental office at OHSU to the third-year dental students. And what I teach them is when we want to prevent emergencies in the dental office, prevention is key, and not only being prepared and being competent, but also reducing stress, because there's a reason why these events happen in our office and not, say, at the shopping mall or something. But I impose upon my students that reducing stress is key, and sometimes reducing stress requires sedation. And if we can control stress vis-a-vis sedation, then some of our ASA 3 patients who have cardiac histories, uncontrolled high blood pressure, we can help prevent those emergencies by happening with the judicious use. So those are the points I'd like to make. And again, I thank you for the opportunity, Chairman.
And to hear clearly, the ODA is opposing the bill?
Yes, and the ODA is opposing the bill 2834-1.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name for the record is Sarah Wickenhagen. I'm the Advanced Practice Policy Analyst for the Oregon State Board of Nursing. I'm here today to provide informational testimony about the Dash 1 amendments for 2834. I met with Representative Hayden in 2015 along with my executive director and presented information about the practice of CRNAs in this state. That information remains the same, that they are well-trained and educated and prepared to care for all levels of ASA patients, and we have had no single complaint against a CRNA in this state for their care in regards to dental sedation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee for allowing me to testify in opposition to the Dash 1 amendments to this bill. My name is Michael Ray. I'm a certified registered nurse anesthetist and the current director of the government relations of the Oregon Association of Nurse Anesthetists that's here. I want to, first of all, applaud Representative Hayden for his efforts to make sure that we're providing the safest level of anesthesia in offices and in all settings that we have. And I think the CRNAs and Arana really support this effort, that we're all under the same direction, that we want to make sure that clients are the safest that we can be. As Sarah Wickenhagen has presented, we've addressed this issue back in 2015, and we have very similar testimony. I'm not going to reiterate a lot of those issues that we've gone by. We've also have a bullet point list of written testimony that we've submitted that will allow you to review, and so I won't use much of your time going over all those points.
Thank you.
I think part of the question that I want to address here today, though, is the whole issue of the ASA physical status classification system and some of the drawbacks to implementing this into a state law sort of situation, because this is going to create a lot of ambiguity that we have. In order to realize this, we need to sort of look back at the history a little bit of when the ASA classification came about. It was originally written in 1941, and there's not a whole lot of things that we're currently doing in today's practice of medicine that are still from 1941 that we use. And it was originally designed basically as a communication tool to share information between colleagues, create a uniform method of statistical analysis, and the grading system was not intended to be used for a measure to predict operative risk for patients. With that, you know, we've all seen, I think, the six categories that patients are ranked from the highest level or the healthiest level of a level one down to a level six, you know, that you have. Today in this discussion, we're talking about our level two, threes, and fours typically. The problem with the classification levels that we have is that there's a lot of subjectivity between these levels, even between experienced providers that we have. So when people are ranking a patient as either an ASA 1, an ASA 2, or ASA 3, there can be a lot of variability between those patients in terms of one provider may see somebody that has chronic hypertension, maybe a smoker, a little bit sedentary lifestyle, may represent them as a 3, whereas another provider may represent them as a 2. And so where do you start to differentiate that? Because there's not a huge amount of evidence-based science defining that on these peoples. So if I want to look at and just give you a couple of examples where if these amendments were adopted into law, where it would be problematic. So if we look into a current practice that I've typically been involved in, women's health in certain settings that we do gynecological procedures for, say, for instance, women who may have a miscarriage and doing DNCs in an office, a dilation and curettage procedure in an office. So I had a case, you know, not too long ago with a patient that She was a very healthy lady, although she had juvenile diabetes, and she was on an insulin pump. Well, if you look at people who are insulin-dependent diabetics, those patients automatically are categorized as an ASA level 3 patient. This lady, unfortunately, you know, at 10 weeks gestation, she had a miscarriage, and she wanted to have a simple dilation and curettage. So we have safe measures in place to evaluate this. We did her first case in the morning. We have glucose monitoring available. We have, you know, small amounts of insulin available if she should go high, and we had, you know, other glucose treatments. So we were able to effectively deliver a safe care in office setting for her without complications in this. But under these current rules, she would have been excluded from being able to be done in office procedure.
Assume that wasn't a dental office.
This wasn't, but the bill is also saying medical procedures, you know, the other medical offices, and so that they could be included. But you could make other arguments with other possible children, or say, for instance, we take a teenage child who might be slightly overweight and just has a situation of a BMI that's greater than 40. If you are identifying a BMI greater than 40, that is identifies you as morbidly obese and also would be an ASA 3.
You wrap it up, please.
I'll be finished right after this little episode. So my point being, ultimately, is there's patients, as I say, that their categorizations fall on that gray area, and these people are going to be excluded from being able to be done in certain procedures with this as we look at that. And there just isn't the evidence that we have to support ASA classifications as being directed into a state law with it. So as I say, I've submitted some of our testimony. Our testimony from 2015 does not change as well, and I'm willing to answer any other questions the panel may have.
Thank you. Are there any questions in this panel? Thank you very much. Can you call the last witness, please? Are you there?
Yes, he's right there. He knows. I can't
one?
Say his name.
Marlon Michelle. Dr. Marlon Michelle, I'm an anesthesiologist. I am not for or against the bill. I just came down to talk to Representative Hayden about this bill. I think what he's doing is he's got a great idea. This is a start, but we need to kind of get a little bit more specific on certain things. So I just wanted to hear the testimony and put my my testimony in place, too, also. Thank you.
Do you support the bill as it's written? Oppose the bill as written?
No, I'm neutral right now. There's some other issues that I didn't realize until I've heard testimony. That's why I wanted to wait.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2834. The House Bill 2834 and roll over a work session until Friday. And are we ready for the next one?
Sure. I don't. Representative Johnson in the room yet?
I don't see him.
I don't either. Okay.
Okay, well.
Let's go into 2897, this one.
Who else is on 3352?
Just two other people. We could do one panel. Bill Bushka and Morgan Allen.
Yeah, why don't I open up a public hearing on House Bill 3352, okay. Invite a panel, and see if we can get Representative Johnson to join us.
Bill Bushka and Morgan Allen.
What does this bill do, please?
3352, I believe.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3352 establishes a task force to examine funding for behavioral health services in elementary schools in Oregon, designs a task force to include the membership from the Oregon Department of Education, the Oregon Health Authority, and other stakeholders, requires that the task force submit a report to the Legislative Assembly no later than September 15, 2018. At this point, it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Mr. Chair, you have a -2 amendment, which basically replaces the original measure and directs the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Education to conduct an evaluation of the behavioral health services being provided to kindergarten through grade 12 throughout the state.
Right. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Nose and Hayden, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3352. My name is Bill Bushka. I'm the Director of Community Solutions and Government Affairs for Intra-Community Health Network Coordinated Care Organization. IHM is one of the 16 CCOs in the state, and we serve about 51,000 individuals in Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln County. And we recognize the significant value in supporting regional approaches to improve the system of services in conjunction with our community partners. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3352-2 amendments. In OLUS, you'll see a letter undersigned by 10 CCO supporting the dash twos. Each CCO values the provision of health services in a manner that is supportive of our members' needs and environments that have the best opportunities for success. The continued development of close partnerships with our school systems and our regions will allow for maximizing our collective resources to meet the needs of children and adolescents and their behavioral health needs while improving their ability to engage in their education. Through the evaluation outlined in the bill, we'll get the necessary information about the barriers, challenges, and gaps, as well as the best practices that have emerged in communities. Some solutions may be needed at the state level, and some will come from the community level, but there may not be one single solution that will work in all communities with all schools. We know providing services and supports to children and adolescents with mental health needs and their family members in locations most comfortable and convenient to them will lead to better outcomes. For many, this location is the school. Education success is critical to all students in Oregon, and we are especially dedicated to success for students with mental health conditions who are enrolled in CCOs. We had a great opportunity to work with Representative Johnson, and we look forward to work on this important bill through this session. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and that's the dash 2 years.
Dash 2 years.
Chair Greenlick. I haven't seen you for a while here.
Chair Greenlick, Morgan Allen from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Glad to be here, and I apologize. I was in the other committee, so glad I made it in time. And I just wanted to also offer our support for the Dash 2 amendments in House Bill 3352. And just briefly, I think you all know that our school system has increasing challenges to meet the behavioral and mental health needs of our students. That's very clear. And oftentimes, our schools don't have the extra resources, and in some cases, our schools don't have the expertise to take those challenges on. And I think what the Dash 2 amendment does, it really gives us the opportunity to analyze what are the services that are available, where do the gaps exist, and most importantly, how can we move forward to try to eliminate those gaps and get those services to our kids. So we're very pleased to be part of the bill. We're happy to work with the health authority and our CCOs and try to connect folks and figure out what information we could help get from school districts or what folks the CCOs and the health authority would like to sit down with and talk to and help get this started. So happy to support the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you.
They say there was a bill heard in the Education Committee today that I have to try to make social trained social workers more available. That seems to me would be a big piece of it. You're right in time.
Oh, man. First time today. Yeah.
Okay.
Phew.
Your turn.
We'll shift gears. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. For the record, my Mark Johnson, I'm privileged to be able to represent House District 52. Over the interim period between last session and this session, I had a series of listening sessions with teachers in my district where I called them together and in a casual environment over a cup of coffee or whatever, I said, what one thing or two things could I do for you in this next session that would make you more effective and help you in the classroom to be better, you know, a better educator for kids? And the one issue that rose to the top time and time again was the fact that the services that teachers are being asked to provide to students in a classroom today are very different than they have been in the past. And specifically, what they kept coming back to is we have so many kids in our classrooms today with behavioral issues that really make it difficult. We don't, first of all, have the skills to deal with the issues that we're finding. But secondly, the impact that it's having on the classroom environment is really damaging. And as you can imagine, being in a classroom of 30 or more students, elementary students with one or two, maybe three who are severely behaviorally challenged, it's really hard for that teacher to provide quality instruction that's going to lead to better educational outcomes. And really, you know, the state school fund was never designed and never intended to support health care needs for students in the classroom, and especially as it relates to behavioral health. So my first draft of this bill, House Bill 3352, was intended to be very intentional based on input that I received from educators about what we could try to do to make this a better situation. The base bill is focused on trying to provide embedded full-time personnel, FTE, within the public school environment that could be jointly supported with healthcare resources and K-12 funding to be a part of the academic team within a given building. These personnel will be available on a daily basis to assist with student behavioral issues as they arise, but also to be able to identify the root causes of the behavior, because ultimately that's what healthcare is about, right? Let's find the nexus. Let's find the root cause of the behavior. This intentional effort would not only pay dividends in the classroom in the short term, but would provide the systemic benefit of identifying chronic behavioral problems early to keep them from developing into chronic and costly problems for the student, for the system going forward. But in order to get this to this ideal position we have today, I think we need to go through an informational gathering phase first, and that's what House Bill 3352 with the -2 amendments is really all about. It first of all calls for OHA to begin to collaborate with the Oregon Department of Education to conduct an evaluation of current behavioral health services available to public school students throughout the state, because as you can imagine, there can be a wide variety of available services for students through the system that exists. The evaluation shall identify, first of all, barriers and challenges providing behavioral health services across the state, and secondly, gaps in behavioral health services that are being provided and resources that are available for behavioral health services. Sub B of the bill goes on to say that this information should be gathered and then factored into the new five-year plans for the CCOs as they go forth and seek to provide better holistic community health. The bill also describes how these five-year plans could incorporate specific behavioral health outcomes that would also lead to public education benefits. Specifically, one, we would see an increase in mental health referrals and treatments between schools and community-based behavioral health professionals. Two, a decrease in expulsions for students with behavioral health needs. And three, a decrease in chronic absenteeism for students with behavioral needs. All three of these would not only benefit the classroom environment, but have an educational benefit for the system as well, as we seek to decrease chronic absenteeism and issues within the classroom. This bill is intended to begin to break down the silos between healthcare and public education by considering how financial resources might be able to be shared and blended for the common benefit of the state of Oregon. Finally, the bill spells out that the informational process is to be a collaborative conversation that includes COSA, our school district superintendent's organization here, who knows better about what's going on in public education than the superintendents that run the schools, and the CCOs throughout the state. As a school board member for the last 12 years, I can really tell you that this is a really, really important topic, and it really is timely, and I really hope that we can make some progress in moving forward to a better collaborative relationship between healthcare and public education for the benefit not only of our healthcare system, but for our public education system in Oregon as well. So with that, I have some support here as well.
Any questions, panel?
No, I just want to thank you for bringing this forward. An important issue.
Thank you. Okay, we don't have the paperwork for it. Unless we get the paperwork before we're done here, we'll roll the work session over till Friday and close the public hearing on House Bill 3352.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good deal. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2897. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, again, this bill, 2897, comes to you at the request of State Street Solutions and one of their clients. This bill prohibits insurers that offers a health benefit plan in the state from restricting covered services to in-network providers. Mr. Chair, what we have, though, is a -1 amendment that replaces the original measure, states that re-credentialing is not required if a physician is in good standing and has not had any action taken against them by the Oregon Medical Board. We have Alan Tresseter and Greg Coodley. Mm-hmm. And
can we start with
the proponents of the bill?
This team, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alan Trussiter, and I'm here today representing Fennel Creek Clinic. And with me is its medical director, Dr. Greg Coodley. I'm mindful of your time, so we will be brief and direct about the I just wanted to let the committee know, which most of you know, but and everybody sitting behind me, so we're only addressing the Dash 1 amendments, which replace the original bill.
Thank you. My name is Greg Coodley. I'm an internist. I've been in primary care practice for 29 years, the last 20 at the Fennel Creek Clinic, where this week we're going to see our 50,000th patient, many of whom are Medicare and Oregon Health Plan. And it's a great job to be primary care, but the reality is, as primary care doctors, we're drowning under the unfunded mandates of the paperwork that's required of us. The original bill was more ambitious. In this one, we're trying to deal with one particular problem, which is the multitude of repetitive forms needed every year to recredential each physician. We have, there was a single form that was established by the Oregon legislature by Oregon House Bill 2144 in 1999, amended in 2012. That's a single form. It's called the Oregon Practitioner Credentialing Application. We have to fill out. But then we have to fill out separate forms for each insurance company, with maybe only a line or two different, but it has to be filled out. For each of those, then, the doctors need peer references. They need forms from the medical director. And by the time we're done, for our practice, we estimate that generates about 10,000 pages of paper a year. So the proposal was to say, and for the vast majority, I cannot remember in 20 years ever having a problem being detected by filling out these forms. So the amendment would propose to replace that for doctors who are in good standing and saying that it would only need to be done for doctors where there were problems, and in this case was defined as people with problems with the Oregon Medical Board. So there are a number of objections which I've heard that have been raised. I'd like to just address those very briefly. One is that the Oregon Medical Board is too overwhelmed to take on anything. But again, doing repetitive forms is not something that actually needs to be policed. A single form should be sufficient. And a second objection that you may hear is that credentialing is required by NCQA or by Medicare. Again, in this case, my answer would be, then let's use the form that was developed by the legislature and amend the bill further, this Oregon Practitioner Credentialing Application, a single form at whatever frequency is required by these outside agencies, whether it's once a year, every 5 years. A third objection was that the legislature in 2013 set up a work group to develop a more perfect form. And I've been told that that should be available in 2018. So that's 5 years. That's longer than it took to develop the atomic bomb. And so I would say, again, we could use the existing form. I would certainly have no objection if there's a more perfect form in a year to change to that. Finally, I've been told that the insurance companies do this to improve quality of care. And again, a single form I could understand, but just having us do repetitive forms instead of spending more time with patients, I do not think that improves quality of care. So I'd like to ask you to consider this amendment. And then again, what other further amendments would seem to make this the easiest and most practical solution that would eliminate this vast overabundance of paperwork that accomplishes no end. Thank you.
I have to agree with you. It seems to me there ought to be a way to credential one time that meets all needs. It might have to be bigger rather than smaller, but there ought to be one form.
If it's one form, and what Dr. Cooley didn't mention, I mean, there are 15 physicians in his clinic. Mm-hmm. So this paperwork is that he described is times 15. So we're the Fennel Creek Clinic generates a ton of paper. And with that many forms coming in from that many physicians around the state, I can't imagine anybody's really scanning through them. I mean, I think, okay, got your form in, let's go over here. And we believe that one form could satisfy all these needs rather than one for everybody.
Thank you, Chair. Having managed a medical clinic, I'm sympathetic to the piles and piles of papers it takes to credential a doc and how time-consuming that is. If you have a doc that comes in from out of state, oftentimes they can't practice because it's so cumbersome of the time it takes. And we need physicians, so you're spot on. It is an issue. I'm just curious, though. I wasn't aware that there is a new form or a new system coming in 2018. Do you know what that looks like, and are you concerned about doing this prior to that coming out? Do we know what that is?
I'm not sure it's really – I mean, it's been promised every year. I was told there was going to be in the beginning of 2017, and now I hear it's going to be 2018. So I think using – if there's already existing form, why not use that? This the form that the legislature developed is much more comprehensive than anything by each of the individual insurance companies. So it encompasses all that information. And as I said, if there's a better form in a year, great. But why make us do it for another 12 months?
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hack, if I might take a cut at that too. Not to denigrate the Oregon Health Authority, because they got a lot of duties to do and a lot of work to do. But they've been working on this form for this credentialing process for at least 4 years. So it may be ready in 2018, but I wouldn't wager my house on it.
Hold your breath. Representative Alonzo Leon.
Yes, I really appreciate this bill as well, and I remember our conversation in my office. I had no idea, as a non-physician, I had no idea that you had to fill out so much paperwork to maintain your position. And I agree with Representative Hack. We need our physicians being doctors and treating people as opposed to spending so much time filling out paperwork that's very cumbersome. And I do hope that we have a system, create a system that will streamline things so it doesn't take you that much time to fill out documents. I really hope that we figure something out.
Thank you.
Representative Jewis, so testimony.
Brief comment. Thanks for bringing this forward. This is a big problem. On your next effort at this, could you consolidate requirement for CME? I don't know if the committee realizes, but for physicians now, we have all different levels of CME requirements, from the Oregon Board to hospitals to surgery centers to the trauma system. Some require 30 years, some 25 years, 35 for another. You have to have a spreadsheet, literally, to track all the different CME requirements. It needs to be consolidated and aligned.
Yeah. I totally agree. I think there's a lot of things that we do that don't necessarily improve patient care and actually add to cost.
Maybe I can't be.
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm confused about something. I'm hoping maybe someone's going to get up and explain what the credentialing process is for, and if it's just a bureaucratic thing that we're requiring people to do, then this probably ought to be looked at. What I can't tell from the amendment is I keep hearing about a consolidated form, something we're going to try in 2018. We've been at it for 4 years. This just seems to wipe all that out and says if you're licensed, you get to practice and you get reimbursed. So I'm confused.
Basically, I am open to any kind of solution that would reduce this. So what we were told is that this would, would eliminate this. But then there's been these objections that have been brought up to the process of having, which I just alluded to. So I guess my answer was, if people feel like the Oregon Medical Board would be too overburdened or there's other reasons to do it, there is an existing form that can, there was originally, I would imagine, developed, so this would be the form, and yet the insurance companies have decided to have that form plus. And it would be an easy thing for the committee to just say, this will be the form until we get a new form.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Nose, I believe the Oregon Health Authority is signed up to testify in this bill, and they can answer all the questions you have currently about credentialing.
Okay, I'll wait.
Well, go ahead.
Well, it's just the amendment. I really am confused because the amendment as it reads basically says there won't be credentialing. If you're licensed by the board, you get to bill and practice. And maybe that's okay, but that's what it says. And because I keep hearing about doing something else, and I'm confused about what I'm voting on.
Can I have a question, too? Yeah. I'll be fast. Thank you, Chair. So I, too, have a bit of concern when I looked at it, too, though, because while I am sympathetic to the amount of paperwork, because I've been there, done that for mm-hmm. the docs, and I know that the OMA requires you to come in and you have to do all that certification, and then in order to get reimbursed or to be a part of the contracting side for the insurance carriers, you have to fill out theirs. So the other piece of this, though, I think that I'm curious about or how you handle is if there's been an issue with a doc, I think part of the reasoning that I understood when I was doing it back then was that then is brought forward to the providers, to the OMA. So it's a kind of a checks and balances thing. So I guess the question I, too, would have, like Representative Nose, is what happens to the checks and balances piece? Is this form sufficient enough to be able to do that?
I think there's nothing on the forms that the insurance company asks that isn't already on this form that the legislature developed. So they're not getting any new information beyond what's already on the existing form. And again, as I was saying, I would argue that the credentialing doesn't really detect significant malfeasance. But if there are reasons for it that I did not previously understand, what I'm suggesting is here's another alternative that certainly would be an acceptable improvement on the current system.
It's going to probably be too late to amend this bill now, so we may be talking about what we have in front of us. But let's get the other witnesses.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just for the record, the OHA person had another meeting, so they stepped out. So we have Elise Brown and B.J. Kavanaugh.
Oh. Elise asked me to come up with her.
And Elizabeth Rimley.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Elise Brown, representing America's Health Insurance Plans, and you all know America's Health Insurance Plans, or AHIP, is the National Trade Association of Health Plans. And for your reference, you have a one-pager in there that's signed by my Oregon members, Providence. I think Jessica Adamson had to leave early. She wanted to be here to testify in opposition, but you see the other Oregon members there, and I won't read that testimony, but I do want to highlight a couple of important things. First of all, obviously we're strongly opposed to 2897 for the primary reason that the bill is written prohibits insurers from credentialing providers. Credentialing is absolutely necessary. It's a protection for our patients. It's also concerning because it violates the National Committee for Quality Assurance, that we refer to as NCQA, and CMS credentialing standards that specify a practitioner must complete the credentialing process before they're able to provide service to a member. They brought up, earlier testimony brought up a little bit of the history around the creation of the bill that was brought to law by Senators Bates and Steiner Hayward, Senate Bill 604. And what it did was require the OHA to establish a program and database for the purpose of providing credentialing organizations access to information necessary to credential or recredential all health care practitioners in the state, and it is expected to go live in 2018. Even the website says it's supposed to go live in 2017. The rulemaking is starting. That whole process has been convening over the last couple of years, and it includes 19 providers from every provider background. So it's,
would that, the intention of that is to produce a single form? To credential for all that all
well,
insurance companies will accept?
Is that Mr. Chair, I was hoping to be sitting next to our representative from Oregon Health Authority to explain a little bit how that process has been. We've had Beth may be able to comment on the one form. I cannot, unfortunately, and again, I was
but
hoping
that
OHM.
Is that the intention, to produce a single way that all insurance companies will document a simple database for all
I can't speak
companies.
To the single form, Mr. Chair, but I will tell you that they're creating a process that's going to be simple that everybody access, so there won't be multiple occasions to check.
A single source of data. That
a single source of data, correct.
Can we get OHA up here to confirm that?
Nobody's in the room.
He's just disappeared.
So just quickly for closing, we just think the Dash 1 undermines all the work that has started in 2013 and has yet to complete, and hopefully by the end of this year or very early in 2018. So that's my comments, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
That sounds awesome. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here on behalf of Cambia Health Solutions in opposition to 2897 and the Dash 1 amendment, and I'm speaking to the Dash 1 amendment today because these are the ones that we were asked to consider. So the bill, the Dash 1 amendment would eliminate our ability to do credentialing and have us rely on the good standing that a doctor may be in at the medical board.
Let's go to the basic question. Is Cambia willing to operate in a single source of data that all insurance companies will tap that single data source?
Chair Greenlick, Cambia is willing to participate in the process by which we're doing this. We helped work on the bill in 2013. My understanding is that the goal was probably to have it look something like the way that you apply to a higher ed institution these days, where there's one common app, and then maybe the organization would ask for additional information. If you're a hospital, you might want a specific kind of information. If you're a certain health insurance carrier, you might want a specific kind of information in addition
so
to
the
common.
So we can be right back in many forms.
Yeah.
I don't know that we would be back to many forms, because my understanding is that we're trying to stand it up so that all the information is submitted through the licensing board, and then we would go to the licensing board to get the information. We wouldn't have to go to the provider. But I don't know how that's going to work on the ground, because we're looking at the implementation piece to it.
BJ?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is BJ Kavanaugh. I serve as Executive Director of 1-4 Chronic Health. We are a chronic healthcare collaborative for patients in Oregon. I'm here today to offer our support for the bill, for the simple reason that we think that a number of the provisions in the bill would make it simpler for patients to access the care and the specialty care and the providers they require throughout their plans. Specifically, that's it. Full disclosure, and I had no idea they were going to be here today. I do receive medical care from Fennel Creek Clinic.
You could be the lucky 50,000 if you hurry over there.
Happy to answer any questions. Like I said, this works towards transparency and what we think is simply a good idea on behalf of patients. Thank you.
Let's ask OHA to join us if we will.
Susan Otter.
Hi, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Susan Otter. I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority. Our office is responsible for implementing the Oregon Common Credentialing Program that was legislatively mandated in 2013. We are concerned that this bill, and particularly the amendment, the Dash 1, would negatively impact our ability to achieve the results we expect to see with the Oregon Common Credentialing Program. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that today.
Very briefly, but that is where you're going, to create a single process by which the credentialing
That's correct, Chair Greenlake. So the purpose of the Oregon Common Credentialing Program is to collect in a single database the information that's currently in our Oregon Practitioner Credentialing Application. We currently have a mandated single form that is required to be used for credentialing in the OPCA form. We'll be collecting that data in the Oregon Common Credentialing Program database centrally. We'll also be collecting the primary source documents and doing a centralized verification of those primary source documents that are required for the credentialing process. So currently today, as you've heard, the credentialing process includes redundancies where one physician, for example, is credentialed by multiple organizations that each strive to collect the same information, ensure it's complete, verify those primary sources, and that data will now be collected in our Oregon Common Credentialing Program, made available back to the credentialing organizations such as insurers for their credentialing decisions.
When do you expect that to be operational?
Chair Greenlake, our Oregon Common Credentialing Program should be live in early 2018. We have just executed our contract with our vendor.
I hope you got the right vendor. Oh, thank you very much.
Here, yeah.
I think we'll close this hearing.
Okay.
Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
I really think it's important. Keep in touch with us. Let us know how it's going along the way. That would be great. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2897. Let's stand at ease for 5 minutes and we'll come back and
review the list again.
Do we have to review?
It's a little strong.
Call. Can we reconvene the House Committee, please? We actually have some work to do. I'm going to open. Where are we?
On page four.
Yeah. We're going to carry over House Bill 2122 to Friday. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3030. Can I have a motion on the Dash 1 amendments, please?
Do you want me to tell you what it is?
You can tell us what it is. That would be nice.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is Representative Hayden's bill. We had a public hearing on March 24th. This prohibits businesses that makes retail sales of nitrous oxide, otherwise known as poppers, right?
Whippets.
nitrous oxide canisters from which an individual may directly inhale nitrous oxide or an employee of a business from selling or delivering the nitrous oxide canister. It imposes 1 year imprisonment or $6,250 fine or both. The Dash 1 amendment changes the selling date up.
The age
of who you can sell to from 18 to 21. Mr. Chair, we have a minimal fiscal impact on the Dash 1, no revenue impact.
Representative Hayden?
Chair Greenlake, I move the Dash 1 amendment dated 4/3/17 to the floor with a to the bill.
Representative Hayden moves the Dash 1 amendment be added, dated 4/3/17, be added to House Bill 3030. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved.
Chair Greenlake, I move House Bill 3030 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended with the Dash 1. House Bill 3030 as amended to the Dash 1 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Representative Nostrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Nose?
Yes. Vice Chair Hayden?
Yes.
Chair Greenlake?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hayden, will you carry that on the floor?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 3030. We're going to carry over House Bill 2300 to Friday, just so we'll have something to do Friday morning. We don't want to be...
Are you kidding?
Remember, we have up to 3 hours on Friday.
Try not to.
We're going
to
need four.
No, I think we'll be all right. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2303. Madam Administrator, what do we have here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2303 comes to us from the Oregon Health Authority. We had a public hearing on this bill on February 8th. This was one of their housekeeping bills. It modifies the date by which a CCO coordinated care organization must report to the Oregon Health Authority proportion of the total medical costs allocated to primary care. It updates statutory language, deleting references of the Oregon Health Policy and Research to the Health Policy and Analytics Division of the Oregon Health Authority. We also have a dash one amendment on this bill, Mr. Chair. It repeals statutes that predate the Oregon Health Policy Board and references to a community-based healthcare initiative that was based on a safety net grant that has expired. Specifies that in addition to the director, a director's designee can appoint members to the advisory committee on the physician credentialing information. Mr. Chair, we have a minimal impact on the dash one and no revenue impact.
I have a motion on the dash one, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the dash one amendment dated March 27, 2017 to House Bill 2303.
Representative Nose moves the dash one amendment dated 3/27/17.
Dash one.
The dash one amendments, I'm sorry, dated 3/27/17, the House Bill 2303. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2303 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
President Nose moves House Bill 2303 as amended with the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny.
Aye.
Representative Yu.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo.
Aye.
Representative Kenny.
Aye.
Representative Malstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Yes.
Chair Greenland.
Yes. The motion carries and goes on the way to the floor. Do I have a volunteer to carry it? Don't argue. Everybody take one second.
You'll write me a little speech?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. I'll volunteer with help.
Representative Kenmer will carry the bill with the thanks of the chair.
It's like nobody look up.
Well, you might get to carry one that's harder if you don't volunteer.
Yeah, I was going to say consent. But, yeah.
We'll reschedule. We are rescheduling House Bill 2310. To Monday the 17th. We are ready for House Bill 2398. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2398.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2398 was a committee bill at the request of the Oregon Law Center. We had a public hearing on February 13th and again. Well, February 13th, and prohibits a healthcare provider from billing medical assistant recipients except as provided by the Oregon Health Authority by rule. Requires the healthcare provider to wait for payment for 90 days before assigning a collection claim. Specifies conditions when the provider can submit a claim for collection. Mr. Chair, we have the dash one amendment, which adds the word applicant and changes a 24-month period to the current federal requirement of a 12-month processing deadline. The dash two deletes the requirement that the OHA or the CCO send notice of a contested case notice to the patient, changes contact to the authority to recheck eligibility, directs OHA to convene a stakeholder work group before reporting back to the legislative interim committees. Mr. Chair, the dash one amendment had a fiscal impact, which then brought the parties to the table and they came up with the dash two. The dash two will minimize that fiscal impact. So with the ones and the twos, we have a minimal.
We need both.
We need both. But the twos unravel the fiscal on the ones, but we do need the amendments. So okay. We have a minimal fiscal and a no revenue, Mr. Chair.
Let's go.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we amend House Bill 2398 with the dash one amendment dated March 7, 2017. And then I'll do a separate motion for the other one.
Right. Representative Nose moves to adopt the dash one amendment to House Bill 2398 dated 3/7/17. Is there any discussion on the dash one? Objection. Dash 1 is added to 2398.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the Dash 2 amendment to 2398 dated April 5th, 2017.
Representative Nose moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2398 dated 4517. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So moved. Always glad to have something that unravels costs. Can I have another motion,
Mr.
sir?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2398 to the floor as amended with the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendment with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves the House Bill 2398 to the floor as amended with the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? You call the roll, please.
Representative Penny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Beeler.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Yes.
Representative Kenner.
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative
Hatch. Aye.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Yes.
Chair Greenland.
Yes, motion carries. Representative Alonzo Leon, would you carry this?
I would love to.
Representative Alonzo Leon. Be the carrier.
The smile came late.
Close the work session. I'm not done yet on House Bill 2402. And what do we have next? 2408.
It's carrier. No, we're not. Are we not doing 2402?
We did this one we need to do.
We haven't done 2402.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You did 2402?
No, we did not. We did not. But it is ready.
Okay. That's got two amendments as well, right?
Yes.
Open a work session on House Bill 2402.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this 2402 comes to you at the request of Representative Lively. You'll recall we had a public hearing on this in February 3rd, to be exact. Establishes the program allowing a homeless individual to obtain a free certified copy of their birth certificate. The program would be housed within the Center for Health Statistics, creates the free birth certificate for homeless persons fund within the state treasury, specifies January 1, 2018 as an operative date. The effective date would be the 91st day following adjournment sine die. We have a Dash 1 amendment which puts into statute the federal definition of homeless individual into Oregon statute. And the Dash 4 is establishing a grant program in the Oregon Health Authority, specifies the administration of that program, and establishes the birth certificate for homeless persons fund in the state treasury. The effective date of the grant program is July 1, 2018. Mr. Chair, we have a fiscal impact on the one, and LFO has requested that the bill be referred to Ways and Means, so if the committee so chooses, we will add a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and that's your choice.
Let's roll.
Does he have this?
I don't have this one.
He doesn't have this one.
Okay. Yeah, you can look over my shoulder.
Well, it can be done. The Dash 1 amendments I do pass to...
Here's the Dash 1.
The Dash 1 is February 2nd. The Dash 4 is the 6th of April.
Do you want me to do it?
Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would like to move that the committee adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated February 2nd, 2017 to House Bill 2402.
Representative Nose moves we adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 2217 to House Bill 2402. Any objection? Any discussion? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that the committee adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated April 6th. To House Bill 2402.
Representative Nose moves the Dash 4 amendments dated 4617 to House Bill 2402. Is there any discussion on the amendment and the motion? Any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that House Bill 2402 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation, but be
as
sent
as amended.
God. but also be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Be referred. Representative moves. We send House Bill 2402 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation, and that a referral to Ways and Means be added. Is there any discussion on the motion? You call the roll, please.
Representative Kennedy. Aye. Representative Alonzo Leon. Aye. Representative Fuller. Aye. Representative Kennedy. Aye. Representative Nelson. Aye. Representative Haddon. Aye. Vice Chair Nose. Yes. Vice Chair Hayden. Yes. Chair Griffin. Yes. The motion carries. The bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2402. House Bill 2408 will be carried over till Friday. House Bill 2503 will be carried over to Friday. House Bill 2580 will be carried over to Friday. And open a work session on House Bill 2751. What do we have there, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2751 comes to the committee at the request of Representative Barreto. We had a public hearing on this bill on March 13th. The bill allows occupational therapists to participate in the Primary Care Provider Loan Repayment Program, extends the sunset of the Primary Care Loan Repayment Program to January 1, 2025, has an emergency clause. Mr. Chair, we have a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no amendments, Mr. Chair.
There's no fiscal impact because this just makes them eligible. It doesn't automatically
Correct.
Give them anything.
Correct. It adds them to the list.
Can I have a motion, please?
Chair Greenlick, I move House Bill 2751 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves House Bill 2751 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kennedy. Aye. Representative Fuller. Yes. Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kennedy.
Aye.
Representative
Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Haddon.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Nose. Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. The motion carries. Whose bill was that?
Representative
Barreto. We ask him to carry the bill, please.
Sure.
Close the work session on House Bill 2751. We are ready for open a work session on House Bill 3085 for the purpose of moving the bill to revenue.
Chair Greenlick, I move House Bill 3085 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways to Revenue.
By prior reference.
Representative Hayden moves House Bill 3085 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion on the bill? Madam Minister, you want to just comment on what the bill is?
Oh, Mr. Chair, this was a Senator Steiner Hayward bill. We had a public hearing on the bill March 27th that establishes the Healthcare Professional Training Fund. And it does have a revenue impact statement.
I bet. would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kennedy.
Aye.
Representative Fuller.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Haddon.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair
Greenlee. Aye. Most carries the bill is on its way to revenue. We're going to carry over House Bill 3276. Carry it over to Friday. I think that's the list.
And that's it.
I tell you, I'd like to stand at ease for a moment and let Sandy and I review everything and reiterate, make sure we have everything carried over, but you needn't wait.
Yeah. We need a quorum if you're at ease.
We need a quorum. All right.
Just sit tight. You're gonna
we'll wait.
Yeah.
On House Bill 2408.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we just got the fiscal impact on 2408. You'll recall that this also is a Representative Lively bill. We had a public hearing on this March 24th. This This appropriates $3 million general fund to the Oregon Department of Education to plan, establish, and operate new school-based health centers, to increase student access to school-based mental health providers, and to fund a pilot program that uses trauma-informed approaches. Mr. Chair, there are no amendments on the bill, no revenue, fiscal statement, and it does have a Ways and Means referral by prior reference.
Representative Notes.
Okay. Jeez, gotta figure out how to make the motion.
Let me figure out this.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2408 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation, but be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2408 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Good discussion on the motion.
Yes, Representative Hayden.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I'm supportive of the intent behind this bill, but as I've stated before, as we move forward with coordinated care organizations and moving our community benefit, I think that funds coming in the healthcare arena should stay in the healthcare arena and maybe have the community benefit practitioners engage with the schools and have the schools work on education. So I will be opposed to this just based on the amount that money that it would take to do it, and my preference would be to have it come through health care dollars rather than Department of Education.
And I'd comment, I think I generally agree with you, but if it goes to Ways and Means, they find a different way to fund it down there, it would be worth funding. We obviously, I think, have to make sure we're dealing with these issues and ways are important. So while I think it's not perfect in its current form, and I agree with you on that, Representative Hayden, I would vote in favor of the bill to move it to Ways and Means and hope to straighten it out there. Any other discussion on the motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kenny Dyer.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
No.
Representative
Alonzo
Leon.
Aye.
Representative
Ketamer. No.
Representative
Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Pack.
No.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
No.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. I think if I counted right, the motion carries. Those are its way to Ways and Means.
Counted right.
Will you repeat what we think of the bill? I think we've mentioned everything that's either been rescheduled or goes to or carried over to Friday. But let's review.
Okay. 2834 had a public hearing. Work session was carried over to Friday the 14th. 2897 had a public hearing. 3352 had a public hearing. Carried over the work session to Friday the 14th. 3415, public hearing, carried over to Friday the 14th. Hold on, I have my pages out of order. I still have my pages out of order.
That's all right. There's a lot of order.
Work session 2122.
2122, work session carried over to 414. We passed out 3030. Carried over 2300 to Friday the 14th. Passed out 2303, rescheduled 2310 to Monday the 17th, moved out House Bill 2398, moved out House Bill 2402, moved out 2408, had a work session on 2503 got carried over to Friday the 14th, 2580 got carried over to Friday the 14th, 2751 moved out of committee, 3085 moved out of committee, 3276 got carried over to Friday the 14th, and we announced that House Bill 2391, 2835, 2837, 3440 that were all scheduled to be moved to rules got rescheduled to Monday the 17th. Does that match everybody else's?
Yeah, that's it.
Great.
Good.
That's
thank
it.
You very much.
Thank you.
Committee, thank you for your patience. We'll do we have any public hearings on Friday?
Yes.
We sure do.
Four, I believe.
They're doozies.
Well,
yeah.
Well, I think what we'll do is do the work sessions first and divide up the rest of the time for the public hearing.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Woo. We are adjourned, and you guys get the dinner at 5:30. Thank you very much. Woo. We are adjourned, and you guys get the dinner at 5:30.